I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. This show is where we host thoughtful conversations with people across my personal and professional network who possess deep experience, wisdom, and insight about the issues shaping our communities, our economy, and our future. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us continue bringing forward together leaders and thinkers who are willing to have honest discussions about our state and country. Visit LockedIn.cash to become a reoccurring supporter. Your contribution helps us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. Housing has become one of the most defining economic issues of our time. Whether you're trying to buy your first home, rent an apartment, invest in real estate, or simply understand why affordability continues to dominate the national conversation, housing affects all of us. Over the past several years, we've watched interest rates climb, construction costs increase, financing become more difficult, and communities across the country wrestle with how to balance growth, affordability, and quality of life. The question is no longer whether housing is changing, it's what those changes mean for the future of our communities and our economy. Today's guest has spent decades helping answer that question. Clay Grubb is the CEO of Grubb Properties, one of the country's most respected multifamily developers with projects spanning numerous markets across the United States. His company has navigated multiple real estate cycles while continuing to develop communities in an increasingly complex environment. Grubb Properties is also a partner with Northridge Opportunity Fund, giving us an opportunity to discuss these issues from both a national and an investment perspective. Today, we'll explore what's really driving the housing affordability challenge, how higher interest rates have changed the economics of development, where public policy helps, and where it creates unintended consequences, and what the future may hold for housing, commercial real estate, and investors. Clay, it's great to have you back on, man. Thank you for locking in with me. How you been?
Great. Thank you, Algernon. It's great to be back.
Yeah, well, I guess let's start with the most obvious question. It's been a couple of years since you've joined us for a conversation, and I know the market has been so complex and challenging, but what are you working on these days? What's keeping you excited in terms of development?
Well, we're staying busy. Development has gotten to be extremely challenging throughout most of the Sun Belt. We currently, Thursday, though, held the topping off for our Link Apartments 8 Carlisle in Lower Manhattan. That's a 67-story building that we're excited about bringing to a market that is really starved for housing. It's kind of interesting. New York is literally probably the single most housing-constrained market potentially in the world right now. And you take Central Park all the way down to the Statue of Liberty. We have the only crane in the entire skyline building apartments at a point when they desperately need it. And so that's been exciting. And working on other projects around the country that have also been exciting, and continue to love being a part of downtown Winston-Salem as well.
Well, that has to be exciting. I know more about your background and some of your family history than most of my audience, but your family is right out of the triad, little old Lexington, so many years ago. And now look at you, you're actually building apartments in Manhattan. Talk a little bit about your family history before we get into talking more about the market and sort of what you're seeing in terms of trends right now.
Yeah, well, it's kind of fun. I mean, my great-grandfather, who also went by the name of Clay Grubb, built one of the first steel and concrete high-rises in North Carolina on the square there in Salisbury. And that's still ranks as the tallest building in Salisbury, and unfortunately he didn't live to see it finished, and the Wallace family bought it, and it's been through a series of ownerships, and the Wallace family just bought it back a couple months ago, and is trying to restore it back to its glory. And I've been helping them a little bit. So it's been a fun project that'll be really wonderful for downtown Salisbury. And then my family was involved in a lot of different things throughout the history of Lexington. My mom was very instrumental in getting the power underground on Main Street, and really trying to revitalize that downtown. And I think those have turned out to be wonderful projects. I mean, you go to these downtowns and they were quite vibrant today. It was interesting. We were there for over Christmas a couple of years ago, and one of my family members commented that it felt more vibrant than downtown Charlotte. So it's exciting to see that happen. And my father, actually, I think you are well aware, started out as actually a home builder in redline neighborhoods in Davidson County, and put hundreds of predominantly Black families into home ownership that really kind of set the trajectory for their children to attend college and do things that they otherwise may not have had that opportunity. And so that's a great legacy that we try to continue to build on, and try to bring that kind of compassion that my father showed in the home building business to our day-to-day operations still at Grub Properties.
You know, housing is so critical, no matter what city or community or state you're having the conversation. Right now, Clay, it seems like almost every city in America says it's in the middle of a housing crisis. From your perspective and your experience, what do you think actually caused it?
Well, there's a lot of things that caused it. And, you know, and unfortunately, the Obama administration gets probably the bulk of the blame. It was really interesting. You know, what happens with politics is they always overcorrect. And, you know, before the global financial crisis, we had ample housing everywhere. And, of course, we created a financial crisis around the globe with subprime mortgages and the exporting of those mortgages, and primarily the fraud that got into the system. And as a result, coming out of that, the response was to really crack down on allowing the American individual to buy a home. And at a time when homes were probably the cheapest they've been since the Great Depression of the 30s, we basically said, all right, the average American can no longer buy a home. And so Wall Street ended up buying millions, tens of millions of homes. And those homes have tripled in value and creating billions of dollars of wealth that could have been spread across tens of millions of Americans. And instead, it's concentrated on Wall Street. And so that's been a real problem, because as a result, the home builder has struggled, and we've continued to struggle. And then coming out of COVID, we've seen rapid increase in construction cost. We've seen, really, it's interesting, the last 15 years, we've seen probably the highest housing inflation that we've seen in 100 years. Yet the Fed, for most of that, was basically saying there's no housing inflation. So I think the Fed has a role there too. I think their index in which they track housing in the CPI is just wrong. And they underestimated how much inflation was in the housing market for 10 years, and now they're overestimating how much inflation is in the housing market. And so there's a lot of things we could do to change a lot of this, but it's difficult. And one of the things that I have a lot of passion around is trying to get folks more access to home ownership, and coming up with a product that actually creates a safety net for, like, if you go to the hospital for 6 months, you don't risk losing your house, because you think about it, over 30 years, life happens. But also, one of the big experiments that the data has shown, which I don't think has been publicly endorsed and shared enough is that during the global financial crisis, the reality was the homeowner, whether they paid their mortgage or not, had nothing to do with the value of their home. And so they, you know, if somebody's home was underwater and they owed $100,000 more on their home than it was worth, the 99% of Americans still make their mortgage payment every month. And so this whole concept that you got to clean out your 401k and your IRA to put a deposit down on a home is for moderate homes and first time home folks, it is really just a farce. I mean, we have 100 million Americans that rent, have zero equity in their home, and they make their rent payments every month on time.
You know, whenever I talk to you, I've had several conversations where you talk more about, I think, the social and the community aspect of housing and the importance of making sure that everyone that needs to have access to housing have equal access. You don't always speak like most developers and builders that I talk to. So for the public at large, what misconception do you think they have about developers? Because I think a lot of times the public just feels like developers just want to make money and that's it. But when I have conversations with you, you're talking more about the social aspect of housing just as much as you talk about making money.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we're a capitalistic society, so you have to make money to stay in business. And so you've got to have good, sound projects. And that's a big, you know, problem is a lot of communities want affordable housing, but, you know, you can't mandate it. And the more you mandate it, the less affordable housing becomes. It's been proven over and over again. I mean, Houston has zero zoning, and they're probably one of the more, certainly for being such a large metropolitan, it's extremely affordable compared to, you know, California, that, you know, prides themselves on helping people with the affordability. You know, to build an affordable home in California is four times more expensive than to build one in Texas. And so there's nothing affordable about it when it costs $1 million to build an affordable unit. And so it's a massive problem that I think most communities get wrong. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people gravitate to the development world because they want to improve the areas they live, whether it's in their community. And, you know, certainly they see financial opportunity as well. And, but I don't know a lot of developers that go out there and say, hey, I want to build a really ugly project just so I can make money. Most people take a lot of pride in what they're building and, you know, and they live in the communities where they're building a lot of times. And so, you know, they have to be more thoughtful. So I think there is a real misconception there. And certainly there's bad actors in every industry. And the problem is the political environment tries to govern for the bad actor as opposed to trying to govern for rewarding the good actors. And that's just a real problem with politics in general. And I'm hopeful that, you know, those times will change, but, you know, they won't change quickly.
You know, I think everyone you talk to these days agree that housing has become too expensive, but it seems like there's not universal agreement on how to actually go about fixing it. You know, developers and builders have a set of ideas, policymakers are thinking a little bit different. Our elected officials, obviously, they always have their own ideas as well. What policies are actually increasing the supply of housing and bringing pricing down? Like, what's actually working right now?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, North Carolina just took a real bold step in eliminating the requirement for parking in most urban cities. And that is going to be a real game changer in the housing industry. I mean, you still have to park, but the reality is, you know, this younger generation's owning fewer and fewer cars and We build a product under the brand Link Apartments and really try to focus on the young professional and primarily the young single female, because she still suffers a gender pay gap and some other things. And we now find that, you know, the most cars we park on any property is 0.75 cars per bedroom, whereas historically that number would have been 1.2 cars per bedroom. So you're talking about almost a 40% decline in parking demand. And that in itself, you know, is millions of dollars in savings. What most people fail to appreciate is that a structured parking space in an urban environment typically costs about $30,000 per parking space. And if you go underground and under a building, which is what most municipalities would like to see people do to hide the parking, you know, you're talking about pushing up to 50 to, in some cases, as much as $80,000 per parking space. So that's what we have to spend to house a car. And then you've got, you know, the average American spends over $12,000 a year on their car. So if I can charge you $3,000 less a year in rent, and you can avoid paying $12,000 on a car, that $15,000 for, you know, our median renter in the Southeast earns $52,000 a year. Well, if you can change their economic trajectory by $15,000, and sure, yeah, you got offset, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 for Ubers and Lyfts and some things they may have to do. They don't have a car, but you're still talking about, you know, 20%+ change in their economic trajectory, which is pretty significant. So that's an exciting one that has gotten passed. You know, I'll tell you that the federal level, the new housing legislation, it doesn't have anything in there that I see is going to be helpful other than for the mobile home industry, I don't know how impactful that is as we continue to urbanize across the U.S. And so we definitely need a lot more leadership in that area, especially at the federal.
I mean, do you think that, like, coming back here to North Carolina again, and I agree with you, I haven't completely read the policy, but I was talking to a developer over the weekend and they were already getting pretty excited about what the General Assembly did here in North Carolina. Do you think that North Carolina, in terms of through the General Assembly, should the General Assembly be looking at comprehensive zoning reform that pushes down to some of the municipalities, or should they continue to just give municipalities the autonomy to sort of figure out the housing crisis?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of movement in the zoning over the last 20 years. You know, I think we got rid of the old protest petitions. And so I think you continue to see progress there. And I do think to get more aggressive would make a lot of sense. You know, it's interesting. California for 50 years has been the poster child of everything that you've done wrong. Today, they're really the poster child of what you need to do right at the state level. You know, there's a lot of people bucking it, but you actually lose state dollars if you don't increase your housing supply by a certain percent every year. And so all of a sudden you have municipalities like Santa Monica that are super expensive, historically very exclusive, now, you know, coming to developers and saying, hey, you know, it took us, you know, a year and a half to get a site approved for 60 units in Santa Monica. And they came to us and said, hey, we've got to hit our state numbers. If you guys will resubmit, we'll approve over the next 120 days, increasing that to 100 units. And so you're giving these municipalities incentives to really start to drive up the housing. And to me, that's probably preferable to mandating what the zoning is, because at the end of the day, zoning is kind of, you know, unique by municipalities, and you need some control. But at the end of the day, you need to have a carrot and a stick for housing in general. And it's interesting, like a community like Atherton is fighting the state and saying, hey, you know, we're not going to build more housing. Well, I don't know if you know Atherton, but, you know, the median home price in Atherton is, last time I checked, was $6.8 million. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they may not have places for people to build dense housing, but that's fine. They don't really need state money anyway, because those guys got so much wealth, they can afford to take care of a lot of the services that the state would take care of. So I do think starting to think like that and create, you know, carrots and sticks that reward and penalize municipalities is a way to go. The other thing that I think is really interesting, as you said it, and nobody's really had the conversation, and I haven't thought about it a ton, but at the end of the day, the building inspections is a real problem, and it's unique by municipality all across the United States. And that's one of the primary reasons we don't have modular housing, is because you can have one municipality that embraces it, right next door one that opposes it. And so it's really hard to scale, and the inconsistency you get in it makes it difficult when you go from municipality to municipality. And I can tell you, you know, Winston-Salem has been blessed with a great building inspections department. My team loved building in Winston. They said it's their favorite market to build in. And it's interesting, you go to a market like New York, they are all about business. And so, like, we had a job site that the neighbors called, complained, had it shut down. The inspector came out, found a couple of violations. You know, we're like, oh no, this is going to be a nightmare. Well, we fixed them that evening. The inspector came back out at 10 a.m. the next morning. Within 24 hours, we were up operating again. And very few municipalities have that kind of reaction time. You know, a municipality like Atlanta can take weeks. And so we had a lot of problems there. And then during COVID, they privatized inspections. And I said, and that cut the cost of our project by almost $1 million because of how much faster we could deliver by not having to wait on an inspector who would show up and say, hey, I've got time to walk six units and find a violation on two or three, and then it's out of there and didn't come back for 2 weeks. You know, when you have a private inspector, you can say, hey, look, you know, we've got 45 units. We'll pay you overtime if you'll stay and finish all 45 of those. And if you see problems, we'll fix them. And can you come back tomorrow and reinspect? And so there's a lot that can be done that would really streamline the total cost of construction. And that's probably the number one, is trying to figure out how to get, you know, approvals for building inspection. Because the one thing that the building inspector and the politician doesn't appreciate is the time value of money. When you're building like a multifamily project, and say you're building a project that cost, you know, $50 million, by the time you're 80% into it, you get a 30-day delay. Well, a 30-day delay, you know, you're still paying interest on all your money. Your investors are still expecting returns. And, you know, so you're talking about, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a day, maybe even $30,000 a day on some of those projects that adds up. And all of a sudden, you know, it's not long, and then you're, you know, $1 million over budget and you don't know why. Well, a lot of that is time value.
Now, you know, you talked about the building and the cost of construction. I totally agree. I mean, you know, have those conversations offline. I mean, costs have just went through the roof. You factor in higher interest rate costs on top of it, and it just gets even more significant. And then just the cost of regulation itself. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's a perfect storm here. Do you see any emerging new technologies or innovation when it comes to construction materials that could bring down the cost of construction? One thing I keep hearing about, and you have a lot of experience of in California, is this concept around 3D printing of material. I mean, is that real? I mean, is there a real vision around that in terms of bringing down the cost of construction as we go forward? Or could that also bring down the cost of housing as well by going to a different type of actual construction material?
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's a lot of innovation in the construction world, but at the same time, there's a lot of resistance in the construction world to innovation. And you've got a lot of processes that are the same they were 100 years ago. And we've seen it, you know, as people become more efficient, you'll get, you know, prefabricated panels that you bring on site that you can pop up. 3D printing is certainly an interesting one, but I mean, a 3D printer is, you know, it's not something that you just attach to the, you know, throw in the wagon and take it to a job site and print out, you know, a house. And so there are places for these things. But it was real a shame. Katerra, was the poster child of everything that you could do right to become the poster child of everything you could do wrong when their spectacular bankruptcy happened. And that was a shame because they had a lot of innovative things they were doing. And, we actually invested in a company out in San Francisco that was doing a lot of innovative things around trying to bring the interiors together much quicker. And so they would have the prefab wiring and plumbing and doing lighting through ether and a lot of things. And so there's a lot going on, but I would say most of it's at the margin. And none of it's truly revolutionary. They precast a lot of things in China and ship them over. And, you know, that was working for a little while. And then now there's a lot more resistance to that. But there seems to be more discussions around sourcing in China again today than I think there have been the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
You know, the past 2 years or so, it feels like we've moved into a real interesting economic environment. We don't see unemployment necessarily shooting up fast, but we don't necessarily see companies moving quick to hire people. A lot of companies are slow to fire, but they're also slow to hire, and that's also starting to cause some stagnation in wages. For your product, like the Link, for example, that you have here in downtown Winston-Salem, what are you seeing in terms of occupancy? And then also your lease rates per square foot, are you starting to see any softness because of what's going on with our job market?
Well, there's no question that rent growth has, I won't say stagnated, but it is declined substantially. And I think that has to do with a lot of fear in the system. There's fear from AI taking your job. There's fear from the war. There's fear from inflation. I don't know what barrel oil is today, but it keeps, you know, bouncing around 100. And that makes it challenging. And it's really interesting because right now we are probably in the greatest energy inflationary period that we've seen with AI and data centers. You're seeing probably, you know, a lot of folks are projecting that, you know, we go at a quadruple supply of energy we produce just to keep up with the AI. And we are losing the energy race to China. China creates more solar in a day than I think we do in a quarter. 3 months, and I think they are doing like a gigawatt of solar every 6 hours and doing probably 3x that in wind. And you know, right now we're paying folks to shut down their wind farms, you know, that are 80%, you know, complete, and we're paying them to not finish. And we're in a huge energy crunch. And, you know, I think the municipality here on Lake Norman just had like a 30% increase in their water rate. And obviously Duke Energy was wanting a 15% increase in their energy rate. I think they settled for something more like 7-8%. But that's still, I mean, that's still hugely inflationary for every single American. And you know, we have got to get way more focused on winning the energy war, and attacking, you know, sustainable energy options is absolutely the wrong way to do it. And focusing on oil and gas is the wrong way to do it. I think that, you know, certainly oil and gas has its role, and there's no reason to attack oil and gas and say it's the bad guy, but we certainly have got to be extremely innovative if we're going to try to keep up. You know, right now China's just, I think they're outstripping us almost 10-1 in the creation of new energy. And you know, and they're moving, you know, I think they just this past month went from first time ever less than 50% of their energy was from coal. And I think that, you know, I think 2 years ago, Europe surpassed over a third of their energy was from sustainable sources. So we've got to get a lot more innovative there. And that's going to be critical because, I mean, we need energy to build buildings. We need energy to run buildings.
Yeah, I think we're going to continue to have a lot of conversation around innovation. I know that I read in The Economist that China is also researching and developing ways to put these data centers underwater. And, you know, obviously believing that that also keeps them cooler and that type of thing. And then you've heard Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk talk about placing data centers in space. So I just think, you know, the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have some really interesting conversations when it comes to these data centers. And then also the emerging conversation around the creation of these mini data centers. I read in a magazine where they talked about you could have these smart neighborhoods that are powered by many data centers that are actually installed next to the subdivision. So it's just going to be a really, really interesting conversation as we continue to evolve. And me personally, I used to be a Governor McCrory, when he was governor of North Carolina, appointed me to the North Carolina Energy Policy Council. And we always just seemed to believe and advocated for an all of the above strategy when it came to energy. That yes, fossil fuels certainly must be a part of the conversation because you don't want to artificially increase the price of energy as you're trying to make this transformation from fossil fuels to renewables and alternative sources. But we should be looking at everything, including nuclear and everything that allows for us to produce energy effectively and you know, at an efficient cost. When you look out over the next decade or so and you think about artificial intelligence and all of the things that are starting to happen right now, Clay. I mean, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, the world got introduced to ChatGPT, and it feels like 36 months later, the entire world looks different. What do you see happening in a multifamily over the next decade as we start to move and engage in this new world that we're moving into?
Yeah, I know it's an interesting world, and we do spend time thinking about it and talking about it, and the energy, you know, is a big part of it. You know, now they're talking about micronuclear facilities, and a buddy of mine, you know, believes that you know, in the next 5 years, which I think is maybe a little too bullish, they were going to break through, and I said people are going to have all the power they need, and you know, with ChatGPT and Anthropic and all this, you're going to potentially revolutionize how we operate. I mean, it's been interesting as social media erupted. It has caused, you know, great division throughout the world, and the question is, can AI, you know, as opposed to selling you a theory and ramming it down your head and replaying it, you know, 20 different ways of why, you know, this politician is a bad person, you know, can really start to liberate and use true factual data to say, hey, yeah, this has happened, but here's the other side of that. And so it could be really revolutionary. You know, the one thing that it's interesting because, you know, you can't pick up an article today where they're not talking about, you know, some parent going, well, what does my kid do? And what should they study? And the beauty is at the end of the day, you know, you can have all the AI you want, but you got to live somewhere. And so that brings me great comfort in housing. And currently we're in a housing recession from an investment standpoint, especially on the rental side. So it's a really unique time to invest in housing because it feels like it's one of the most resilient things you can buy. And now you can buy it for about 35% cheaper than it costs to build. And so we're really focusing on, all right, how do we increase our exposure and go long in housing? Because I do think, you know, it's not going to be dynamic like, you know, hey, if I had SpaceX, that would be fantastic. But, you know, for every SpaceX, there's 10,000 companies that went bankrupt. So the chances of hitting that SpaceX are pretty slim. And that's where I think housing feels good. And, you know, it's interesting. I teach real estate at Tulane, and I hadn't really thought about it to ask the question, but, you know, I probably had a 50% increase in enrollment in my class from this year to the prior year. And so I think they are seeing a lot more folks starting to gravitate to the real estate industry. It's a hard asset that's going to be, you know, that and artificial intelligence isn't going to.
No, I was not aware of that trend, but that makes a lot of sense that you would see more and more people gravitating towards real estate. I think the real estate industry is already changing, you know, significantly with artificial intelligence, especially on the residential side. I mean, you're just seeing more and more AI agents get deployed instead of people working with actual real estate agents. I think on the commercial side and the multifamily side, that's a bit harder to do because of just the type of assets they are and all the moving parts. But even within the architectural and the engineering space, I'm seeing it a lot of rollout of artificial intelligence. You know, nowadays you can actually have a layout done, whereas before you would have had to call a architect to get you to, you know, get them to do a preliminary layout and you spend $3,000 on it. Well, now you can do it on Claude and it doesn't cost you anything. So it feels like to me, Clay, and I saw you getting ready to make a comment, but it feels like to me though, no one's really safe right now in this new revolution that we're going through. You know, before back in the 90s, especially when I was still in high school, it was like the people that were tradespeople, the electricians and the plumbers and HVAC techs, they all got demonized. And people said, hey, if you go into this white collar space and become an accountant or an engineer or an architect or whatever, you're always going to be safe. Well, it looks like artificial intelligence is weighing in a different kind of way. And now saying if you're a professional, you may not be safe. But if you're a plumber, an electrician or an HVAC guy, there's a ton of work for you to do right now because all these data centers are being thrown up all over the country.
Yeah, no, I a couple comments there. I mean, it's interesting because just reading about this, you know, this is one of the Chinese perspectives, but that AI is going to hurt China a lot less than it's going to hurt the U.S. because they don't have a lot of white collar jobs. And this is an attack on the white collar job, which is interesting. And but, you know, and I always joke we build small urban apartments in or small apartments in urban areas. And I you know, it's kind of the equivalent of workforce housing in cities, but I said, you can't really call it workforce housing because that connotates that it's designed for a blue collar employee. And I said, in these cities, the blue collar employees make way too much money to want to live in our small apartments. And so it really is, we call it essential housing because we're housing a lot of the essential employees of America. And they're the hospital staff and things like that. And it's really interesting, though. I mean, you know, I think about, like, we now use Elise AI and I think last year, so I mean, I don't even know what the numbers are this year. Last year, they filled something like over 100,000 inquiries about leasing after hours. The average response to each inquiry was 21 seconds. And the amount of leases that we actually get is pretty significant. And so it's funny how we now, you know, drive-by used to be 40% of our leasing. Now it's probably 40% coming from online and those sources and reviews. And we get people moving in that have never talked to a human at Grub Properties. Now the problem is a lot of them have never lived on their own either. And so, you know, just showing them how to work an elevator and a mailbox key requires human touch. And so what we found is that it is not in any way form reducing the staff that we hire. Now, we've known some companies that have tried that, and we think that that's the wrong way to go. At the end of the day, it's still a customer service business. And the beauty is our team now has more free time to focus on that customer service and help those folks get set up and get moved in and figure out where the trash chutes are and help explain how the recycling works and those things. And so you still have to have that component of it. But we are capturing a lot more. We are dramatically changing the reviews that we're getting by having the customer service, which we now find is that's then how we lead the market in leasing. And is because everybody's looking at what your customer reviews are. And so it's interesting. It's changed things a lot. And it's not all bad.
Yeah, I to echo your point, I keep reminding, and I love technology. I actually went to school for computer science at NC State. And when I came home, I got into financial services at Smith Barney and then ultimately got into real estate. So I ended up not professionally working within technology, but really embrace and love technology because of my background. And I keep trying to remind people that are so fearful that there is going to be a lot of disruption, but I don't think it's going to be. It's not going to be the kind of disruption that people are so afraid of. You know, artificial intelligence isn't just going to get rid of every job. I think it's just going to change the jobs. And then to your point, like with your own employees, it's basically just going to create new responsibilities for your existing workforce. They may not be doing the same things any longer, but you're just going to find new ways to utilize your staff. So I think that's great. Here's one of my last questions. You've spent decades shaping communities through real estate. When your career is finished, what do you hope people say about Grub Properties beyond and besides just all the buildings that you build?
You know, at the end of the day, it's the, you know, it's about people and it's about, you know, humans and, you know, we've got 10,000 people that live and work with us and you want them to feel like they were proud of where they lived and where they worked. And that's nice. You know, we've got great stories from folks that have lived with us for decades. In the book I wrote over COVID that came out, I started out telling the story about the, you know, the guy who brings his 360th payment to Charlotte with his two kids and three of his grandkids to show what it was like to own your house outright without any debt on it. And that was a big milestone, not only in his life, his kids and his grandkids' life, but, you know, in mine as well, realizing, you know, the impact that my father had had on this family. And hopeful that we can continue to do that.
That's really cool. Well, here is my final question, and everyone in my audience knows how much I support and absolutely love all of our local food and beverage businesses. I'm a huge supporter of restaurants, bars, breweries, cafes. I got my first job within a restaurant. And I think restaurants are just so critically important to the fabric of every community, not just here in America, but all over the world. And so, Clay, here's my question for you. Your hometown is Lexington. So what's one restaurant that you'd recommend in your hometown?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously Lexington Barbecue is the famous one in our hometown and still near and dear our heart. And it's interesting for Thanksgiving, for probably 100 years, we've had our family reunion and always had barbecue as opposed to turkey. And now we've gotten a little slacker over the years, so we now get our barbecue from Lexington Barbecue for Thanksgiving as opposed to staying up all night and cooking it ourselves. But yeah, Lexington's got a lot of great spots there, and there's a lot of wonderful spots on Main Street and downtown, and so I always enjoy being down.
This has been another episode of Locked In with Algernon Cash. Clay, thank you for joining us and for sharing your perspective. Housing is one of those issues that touches nearly every aspect of our lives. It influences economic opportunity, workforce development, business growth, family finances, and ultimately the strength of our communities. Conversations like this help move the discussion beyond headlines and politics by providing insight from someone making real world decisions every day. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us continue bringing together leaders and thinkers who are willing to have honest discussions about politics, business, money, and the community issues most important to our state and our country. Visit lockedin.cash to become a reoccurring supporter. Your contribution helps us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. You can also subscribe to my podcast on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Share this episode and send it to a friend. I'm Algernon Cash, and y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.